This is React Podcast. I'm Chantastic. What's up, React friends? This week, we sit down with Jonathan Cottrell. He's the host of the beloved podcast Developer Tea and co-founder of Spec, the very network that this show belongs to. Now, when podcasters get together, they talk. They talk for hours. So, this is part one of a two-parter. Today, we glean from Jonathan's transition from musician to developer. We discover how constrained systems like musical scales overlap technical work, and the ways in which Jonathan sees all systems being infused with humanity. We talk about how to find work that you'll love and what it takes to be a company that attracts passionate workers. This week is made possible by two fantastic sponsors, Level Up Tutorials and TopTal. If you don't know, I have a job. I help teams make good architectural decisions at critical moments, like the start of a project. Unfortunately, I jump around a lot and I can't give teams the ongoing support that I'd like. This week, I helped a team decide that React Spring was the best choice as their animation library. But I needed somewhere to point them that would get them up to speed on the best practices and patterns. I want our team to use React Spring correctly from Go. So I send them to levelup.tutorials.com and tell them to buy Animating React. Scott Talinsky is a compassionate, thoughtful, and thorough educator, and his course, Animating React, is no exception. Now, Level Up Tutorials has tons of great material that I trust on Gatsby, React Hooks, React Testing, and even Vue. So check them out today, buy just the courses that you need, or go pro and get access to everything. Become a better web developer at leveluptutorials.com. You're looking for the next big move in your career. You've done the 9-to-5 office thing, and you've got the merit badges from working at big companies. You're at the top of your game, and what you're looking for now is a way to take control of your career. Go to toptaljobs.com. At TopTal, you can accelerate your career. Plug into jobs with top Silicon Valley and Fortune 500 clients. You can work however and wherever you like at a rate that you set. They have a ton of new and exciting React opportunities, but they're not limited to React. If you want to be a better T-shaped developer and master the entire stack, they have projects that would challenge you in all of the exciting frameworks, new and old. Do you have what it takes to join the world's top 3% of freelance developers? Apply to join TopTal today. Go to toptaljobs.com and take back control of your career. Now, let's get into the episode. Jonathan, welcome to React Podcast. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. I'm home on paternity leave with our brand new baby girl. Her name is Nova Ottilie, and it's been both exhausting and relaxing. It's like the extremes of the spectrum. That's what paternity and maternity leave is like. Don't expect to go out and it be like a sabbatical if you're on the edge of having a child. But we are absolutely loving it, and you know, we've been able to spend a lot of time together as a family. It's been really great.
That's great. When you said that you were open to recording during your paternity leave, I was like, wow, that's amazing. I was just catching up on sleep any spare second that I could.
Well, we learned a lot with the first child. His name is Liam, and he's about 2 years old right now. And so my wife and I kind of made a deal. She does much better with intermittent sleep than I do. And this is going to sound totally unfair and positively weighted in my direction, but she essentially has made the deal with me that she's going to take care of most of the night duties, the intermittent sleep at night, as long as she can trade like taking naps throughout the day and me taking care of the two-year-old.
Okay.
And this actually works out really well. She doesn't feel overly tired. And when she does, I can step in and help out. But it's kind of like this weird, you know, you would read a book that says, oh yeah, take turns during the night, but that actually would just exhaust us both. And it turns out to not be that useful for us. So yeah, we've learned a lot of lessons through it.
Did you have the benefit of paternity leave with Liam, or is this kind of like a new benefit that you got?
I did have the benefit of paternity leave, but it was shorter. Mm-hmm. So we didn't get the chance to, you know, spend as much time. And so I guess during that time, I was much more likely to be up through the night helping out. And of course, you know, we were still learning, you know, why is this kid wanting to eat literally every 2 hours? And so we would have to Google that a few times before we felt at peace. And this time it's like, okay, she just needs this, that, and the other. It's a new experience. Every kid is new, I guess. And you know, some of these experiences too. Every kid is different. You know, it's going to be different every single time. But we had a really good time with him the first time around, and we have flexible work.
Yeah,
we've had flexible work pretty much our whole relationship, which has been really nice.
That's something that I love. I love seeing more and more. Or like better precedent set for that in tech, like being able to take that leave, because it is so, so important that you have that time. I mean, even if it's just for sleep, right? Just to be able to, you know, support, you know, like in your situation, just being available and like, you know, offering that support. I think that hasn't been like kind of a historical precedent, and I don't know how people did it, honestly. Like,
yeah.
I feel like we just barely hung on during that first 3 months.
Yeah.
Even just being able to like sit at home and like figure it out.
Well, I think family dynamics have changed drastically.
Yeah.
And of course I'm not a historian or like of, you know, family dynamics historian or anything like that. But I do think that, you know, the way that things used to be, even 50 years ago, would be drastically different. You'd have, especially in particular, mothers and children at home.
Yep.
And so a community, a neighborhood of mothers would be able to help take care of the child while all of the fathers are off working. Of course, that has changed. And that's not the rule. I just want to be
sure.
Lightly here. You know, if you were to take a snapshot of the average, especially in Tennessee where I am, in the Southeast, the average neighborhood on a given work day, the men are probably working and the women are probably at home. And that has shifted for the better,
yeah.
I think, in a lot of ways. And so my wife and I both, we have remote jobs. So that's one way that that things have shifted pretty drastically. And I'm a huge proponent of remote jobs, particularly for family. I think that's mm-hmm. that's such a, you know, a world-changing shift that we're experiencing as a part of this industry and other industries, quite frankly, that I think is really important. So, but you're right. I think that, like, how in the world, especially if both parents worked, how could you possibly have one person taking care of this child, you know, and not getting their normal income? And it has changed. It's changed a lot.
It is one way that I'm glad that we...
I said, what kind of podcast do you run again? Is this about... we're talking about social dynamics or what is this?
Yeah, it's just something that I'm grateful that we're kind of catching up on. Like you said, like, things have changed. We have more careers per household. And the fact that we're kind of... It feels like we're making progress. It's slow, but steady. We're kind of catching up. People are having the opportunity to do more remote work, be able to set their schedule a little bit, have two careers, and then kind of have these, you know, we're figuring out those like dynamics of like, how do we still bond with our kids and all that. So I'm glad that you're able to take that break and just be with your family and me right now.
Yeah, it's been very nice. And I'm really appreciative of both where my wife works and where I work. She works at a company called Soundstripe, and I work at a company called Clearbit, and where they both have provided us really just very flexible situation for this whole thing. So it's been awesome.
Awesome. Now, about a year ago, you had me on your show, Developer Tea.
Has it been a year? My goodness.
I think so. I think it was about August or September
that
we went on. I know it was kind of like post-summer, like heading into fall type of time.
I guess it was. Yeah. Wow. No kidding.
Yeah. And it was because of that call that I ended up coming on to your network, Spec.
Yep. Yeah. Huh. Yep.
And it's been great. I love it. I've been able to kind of take the show further than I expected to, and kind of like do less of the things that just made it prohibitively costly for me on a weekly basis to actually like make the show work. So I'm really glad to have you back on and kind of like just return the favor. When you had me on, you had this question that has sat with me for the entire year, I think, which was
oh wow
which was if you could, what's something that you wish people would ask you more about? What's something that you feel like you don't get enough opportunities to talk with people about?
Oh, man. See, I ask this question all the time, and I very rarely have a great answer for myself. But I think it changes, and I think that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
So I have a few answers to this. Some of them are just selfish, fun answers. A couple of years ago, I followed in the footsteps of my own father, and I went and got my private pilot's license. And
wow.
This is, first of all, something that I don't often just put out publicly, because I think there's a lot of misconception about what that actually means. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people think that, you know, it's only a highly privileged hobby, and it's not like it's not an unprivileged hobby. It's not like riding a bike.
Sure.
But it's also not quite what the average perception might lead you to believe that it is. It's more like riding a go-kart just with wings. So that's something that I like talking about, especially with other pilots. And I don't get to do that very often, because 99% of the time I'm talking with other developers. People who happen to probably appreciate these kinds of things, but don't necessarily, you know, practice it themselves. So that's kind of the fun answer. The more serious answer, I think, is work psychology and team psychology, particularly for like remote teams. So how those teams can be situated better for success, mm-hmm. but maybe at a deeper scale than just like what you would read on HBR, right? Or what you would hear on a podcast, on an average podcast. You know, I like talking about these things from the level of almost an academic perspective, in terms of like research, you know, what has been proven and what hasn't. These are the kinds of things I'm really interested in. And a lot of the time, these conversations boil down to, you know, practicalities, especially in a work setting. They boil down to, how does this matter?
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, my thinking or the discussions that I want to have are like more theoretical. And usually the practicality comes way down the road after the theory has been, you know, established and tested and all that. And that's difficult. It's difficult to justify talking about the theory when really you need a solution now, right?
Yeah.
So that's something that I often have to kind of rein in whenever I'm talking to other developers or, you know, business owners, whatever, because it's not really something that applies. It's not something we can walk out and try with the workforce, you know, this week or this month.
Well, that's one thing that I have always enjoyed about your show, is that it's obvious that you really like thinking about the academic, more philosophical parts of it. But I've always felt like you have had a really nice balance of trying to come to create a takeaway that people can use to, I guess, have a foothold into that idea. Like, hey, here's something that you can do to start, see how it feels, and then maybe like move more into the lofty side of this idea if it works for your team.
Yeah.
Is that intentional? Like, have you wanted to like kind of bring these concepts into just like a little foothold? Because it seems like, I know that sometimes it can feel nice to just live in academia, kind of like in this yeah. insulated thought bubble. But how much time do you spend thinking about how to bring that to the real world?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the podcast wouldn't be kind of achieving the goal mm-hmm. of helping people without doing that. You know, it's presenting a bunch of theory is helpful to a small subset who can kind of draw the conclusions for themselves. But I do, I mean, it is absolutely intentional to give a practical, here is how you can try this thing that we're talking about, you know, from the lens of evolutionary psychology or something.
Yeah.
Here's how you can apply that when you're writing your React a component. Right, like this is why, you know, this particular part of the programming process, why it is that way, and walk it back. Right.
Yeah.
One of the things that I like to talk about on the show pretty often is, for example, making things small. Right. This is this concept of making your problem smaller, and being able to solve a small problem or fit the whole problem in your brain, that's backed up by so much research.
Yeah.
But we don't have to know all of that research for it to be useful. But it's an interesting topic of discussion, right? It's, okay, you know, you can't keep more than about 7 numbers in your head. So why do you think you can keep 700 lines of code in your head? Right? Like, that's not going to work out.
Right.
And so you know, taking these concepts and boiling them down into more heuristic rules, or I like the way that you put it. It's ways of trying. It's a foothold into mm-hmm. this concept. You know, I never make guarantees on the show. And quite literally in the last episode, I said, take this with like a whole canister of salt, right? Because I'm not a doctor. You know, I'm not like some super seasoned programmer that's been around since the punch card days or anything like that. I'm just a guy who's writing code. And, you know, I've been able to see some things that worked and see some things that didn't. And I also just happen to love applying these concepts to that. And so, you know, I think the theory works, and that's the hope of the show, is to that's kind of the underlying hope of the show, is to take these theoretical sound concepts, real true things, and find ways to, you know, minute by minute apply them. Yeah, that's totally in line with the hope of the show.
Well, that's one reason that I was really excited to have you on the show, is because you seem to have a lot of empathy and care for developers who are on, at some point, on a journey. And I love that. And it feels like there's really always something for everyone in that show. And I just wanted to start, I guess, by going back and seeing what the main kind of sections of your history were as a developer, and kind of what you're drawing from as you pull those lessons out.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting question. Main sections of my career, I think there's two answers to that. One, there are these discrete kind of sections or milestones that maybe I you know, flipped over and had these major turns in my career. Mm-hmm. But you know, on the opposite end of that, there's this non-discrete kind of continuous process that I've been going through for my whole career, and I plan to go through for the remainder of my life, probably. Or I guess actually the remainder of my life. and so, you know, the first kind of section of my career, I think, began when I wasn't doing code at all. It began when I was very young and I got interested in music, and I was so attached to this idea of being able to perform on this thing that had constraints, which turns out to be a theme for my life. Being able to take this constrained domain, if it's a guitar, a piano, or whatever, and develop expertise around it. Mm. And to be able to say, okay, you know, I can actually measure my expertise for this particular thing. It was true for school as well. I had the same feeling of, you know, taking the constraints of the grading system and being able to optimize and get A's in that grading system. So I love the idea of learning around that system of constraints. And music was such an interesting one for me, because it was taking your personality and your emotions and pushing them through this oddly shaped constraint. Huh. And on the other side, another person can kind of like connect to you as a person through that skilled practice, that skilled performance. It's very, it's kind of an amazing phenomenon that we have. It's a different way of communicating.
That's wild. I've never once thought about music as that, like taking this blob of emotion and personal experience and then constraining it through,
yeah,
like kind of, you know, more a much more rigid theoretical like music process. That's fascinating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think anybody who has gone to an opera, for example. Mm-hmm. And if you appreciate operas, it doesn't even have to be opera. It can be almost any musical performance. Mm-hmm. There are strong emotions that you can connect to that experience. You know, you have your own context around a given song. You have your own context around, you know, when you first heard that, you know, what were you experiencing in your life? When we hear music, we tie it back to these moments in our lives, but also for the performer, Of course, they have a lot of emotion. You're basically saying, here is the last, you know, 10 years of my life, yeah. and I'm going to put it on the stage for you. And this is what I have. This is everything I have to give to you. And it's a captivating experience for yeah. both sides, both the person on the stage and the person off the stage. So that's the first part of my career as a developer.
So that's section number one.
Section one, music. Yeah.
Learning how to apply your feelings and thoughts and ideas through a constraint system.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that culminated in me ending up starting study in music. And I quickly learned that it wasn't so much the performative aspect or like the music theory itself. It was more about that communication, connection that I had with this group of people. And the feeling that, you know, I think probably driven as a kid, not having the ability to make a ton of friends. I wasn't, you know, a popular kid, but when I played music, that was captivating to people that otherwise wouldn't really pay attention. And so that was the drug, maybe that that kind of the affirmation drug that drove it all. And so when I started studying music, that kind of got pulled back.
Okay.
Right. That it wasn't so much about that anymore. And I realized what I cared about was being able to connect to this broad audience of people. And so I still wanted to do music. It wasn't like I turned off the switch for music. It's certainly not even to today have I done that. But instead it was, okay, I'm going to do this through it. I'm going to study something different to enable that yeah. communication. So I literally started studying communication. And that was the next step. And, you know, hopefully I was going to give myself the skills necessary to build a platform for myself to become this famous musician. And it turns out that I got really interested in the building process for the platform, because that was another avenue that I could yeah. apply the same, you know, the same passion and skill and all of this through these very clear constraints, and then build these things that people could interact with and love around the world. This is brand new, you know. Of course, this was, when jQuery was in like version 2, right? So like,
okay.
It was a while back. Not forever ago, but it was long enough that
it's been a minute.
jQuery still had like Moo tools
yeah.
on its heels, that kind of thing, right? So it was a good time. And I really loved doing it. And I thought actually that I wanted to be a designer, and I naturally expected that design. Of course you would need to learn how to write JavaScript to be able to do design, right? It was way before we had discussions on whether designers should or could or would want to code, or, you know, that wasn't even the question.
You were ahead of your time. You're a prophet, because that's like anything that everyone talks about now is like how much JavaScript a designer should know.
I didn't know. I didn't know the answer to the question. I just know I wanted the thing to do the thing, and so nobody was going to do it for me. And it's not like I worked at a company, you know. So then I ended up getting an internship, and I applied for a design internship, and they said, you're not going to be a design intern. You're going to be a front-end intern. Very thankful that those people told me that. And from there, I learned JavaScript by being totally immersed in this. This company was full of just kind of superstar programmers. One of the people there was Timmy Willison, who ended up becoming essentially like the core jQuery guy. Another guy ended up at Yahoo. Another guy ended up at, I don't know, Stripe or Recurly. Another guy ended up at Airbnb. I think he's now at Plaid. I mean, they just, once the company disbanded, everybody went to all these, you know,
yeah,
their careers grew.
I mean, it was quite a time, that time in history was quite a time for JavaScript, right? Not that many people mm-hmm. knew it, not many people specialized in it. And so they were really the frontiers in that front end space.
Exactly. And that, and, you know, it was the beginning of the App Store era,
yeah.
right? So we had people that were learning how to build that. And, you know, that was well before Swift. So we had these really cool talks, internal talks about Objective-C. And I mean, for somebody who came from wanting to design, you know, I was drawing shapes in Illustrator. And suddenly I'm listening to this, you know, incredibly talented computer scientist person talking about Objective-C. that was a huge switch for me.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up wanting to do, you know, a lot of developers, I think, grow up with this like fascination for machines and, you know, tearing them apart and learning about all of the, you know, the machine level stuff. I never had that. I never had that opportunity. And so this was that opportunity for me, is being immersed in this machine culture that otherwise I wouldn't have had. And so that really captured my attention. And
yeah,
I went on from there. I learned how to build, you know, some backend things, Ruby, Python. It was actually a Python shop at the time. So I actually learned Python first, learned some Ruby. And then I went and pursued my master's degree because I was still so interested in academia at the time.
What in?
And so digital media, actually. So,
oh, okay, cool.
So a digital media degree, what does that mean? That's kind of like a amorphous thing. Like what is digital media? At Georgia Tech, it's very similar to the work that people at the MIT Media Lab are doing. So that about half of the people who are listening might know what MIT Media Lab is. If you don't know what it is, imagine taking like an arts degree, like a philosophy or a literary degree, and combining it with a practical computer science degree.
Okay.
So a lot of the people who work in this, they end up going into academia, right? They end up doing a lot of work in that space, or they'll go on to do things like video game narrative creation.
Okay.
Right? That's the kind of people that we're talking about.
I love this idea that you, like, even at this point in your career, you're really already straddling that line between like the theory and the practical.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know what else to do. It was like the most obvious form of what I wanted to do. And, you know, I didn't want to go and get I wasn't qualified even for my undergrad to go and get a master's in computer science.
Sure.
So this made the most sense, but also it was the most expressive way that I knew to practice this computer science degree, or I'm sorry, to practice computer science, you know, in the field. And so that master's degree was really interesting to me because it opened up this new way of thinking about computers as this deeply theoretical. This is where I got a lot of my love for theory, was during this master's degree, thinking about computers from the perspective of the human, more deeply, rather than thinking about it as, you know, these are machines that we use for business. It was more like, these are things that are changing the course of our experience as humans. And that seems obvious, right? Eventually, we all kind of catch on to that. But when you study it and you start thinking about the medium and kind of the deeply expressive and deeply human nature that is embedded in these machines, that's when things get really interesting, right? And that's when we start seeing these really cool projects pop up. But also you get to do really fun stuff that like the business world just doesn't support, right? My master's project, for example, was this collective jukebox. So the idea was, you know, you have 5 or 10 people in a given space, and you all want to listen to music. How do you choose it? In the 1950s or 60s, you'd have the Fonz, you know, hit the jukebox, and whatever played is what played, and everybody gets to listen to it. Now a jukebox would be, you know, essentially a queuing system where one person gets served whatever the thing that they like, and then the next person gets served whatever the thing that they like. But nobody ever gets, you know, a collective experience. And so what I built was essentially that collective experience. You all are in the same space. You check into that space in this little app that I built, and it'll combine your music tastes. And then on the other side, it would give you something that everybody theoretically should like. So it actually turned out quite well. It worked really well. The company that provided some of the APIs is now shut down, so the project doesn't work anymore. But there was no way that I could go and build a startup off of that idea, right? There's that wasn't gonna take off. I'm not gonna get investment out of that.
We don't throw enough parties where you know, people want a democratized jukebox.
Yeah, that, and also music taste is kind of like converging.
That's a good point. The algorithm has kind of like made that happen already. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
Now
exactly.
It's just Ed Sheeran, like all the time.
Yeah. Everywhere. It's just everywhere. No, this, and I think that, you know, it wasn't so much that I was deeply interested in making this collective jukebox. It was very fun, but it was more the idea that I could explore a space that didn't have to be commercialized. Mm-hmm. It didn't have to, you know, be justified. It was interesting, and the fact that it was interesting was enough. And in fact, many times during the meetings in my academic career, the discussion would be almost directly, how interesting is it?
Yeah.
Right? Like how unique or different or you know, studyable. What precedent are you setting for people who are coming after you to study this stuff? Not how important is it, not what is the market share, but how intriguing is this?
Yeah.
And that's different. That's very different from the average developer's career.
I have a friend, Sarah Vieira. She's in the React community, and she talks about this all the time. She has a talk. I think it's like build dumb shit or something. And like the idea is that our craft, the thing that excites us, the thing that we were brought to because, you know, we had a computer and then we could make dumb stuff happen in the browser, has been consumed by business now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of our, like a big part of our job is just, you know, making money. And how that is fine, like money's great, but there's another part of our soul that wants to be satisfied by just like making stuff that is fun, making stuff that satisfies our curiosity, making stuff that makes someone else laugh. And we lose sight of that sometimes. And, you know, we try to just kind of like latch onto a cool technology or whatever, something that like we think might satisfy us. But like part of it is just like, we just need to get out there and be like, what do I want to see in the world? Like, regardless of how silly or ridiculous or just unnecessary it is. And just, you know, just make it happen and make somebody's day and kind of like feel better about this thing that you're doing.
100% agree with that. I think, unfortunately, what we end up being coached to do, and even I'm certain I'm guilty of this. I've probably done something like this on Developer T, is to kind of change our perspective on the boring things, and try to cultivate a desire to do them, right? Kind of like building yourself up to appreciate the businessy stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that I'm torn on it, quite honestly, because I think perspective is really important, right? If you can change your mind and cultivate an appreciation for that, for the business side of things, that you're probably going to be a happier person. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you know, if you're actively squashing your appreciation for the boring stuff, right? Well, maybe something is lost there.
Yeah.
And maybe you could do both, right? I guess that's kind of the hope is, can you cultivate an appreciation for the business things rather than cultivating like a hatred for it, right?
Yeah.
But that's the last thing that we want, is because we're going to end up creating burnout for ourselves.
Yeah.
If we hate the work that we do and we're always just like living for the weekend, basically, when we can get back to our little fun side project. But like, what if you could bring them together a little bit more?
Yeah.
I think that's a better future, right?
Yeah. Well, this is something that's really interesting. I feel like it's a big topic right now, that now that, you know, front-end development or development in general has become this like desirable career for people, right? Like, hey, this is the work that I want to do, as opposed to maybe like you and I and a glut of other people that came up in our time, which we were like, oh, this thing is super fun, like I'm just going to do it, and then kind of found that we could do it for a career.
We rolled a really lucky dice is what we did. Yeah, in a lot exactly. of ways, honestly.
There is, you touched on this idea of, there's a tendency that I'm seeing more and more to want to be chasing fun in the work, right? And we see it, at least a way that I see it, is like, in order for me to have fun in my job, I want to install like the latest CSS and JS library, and that'll be like the fun thing for me, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times that's antithetical to like the business goals, right? But then sometimes businesses are like, oh, well, we got to keep our people happy. So like have all the autonomy that you want, like, you know, install the thing, even if it's like gonna, even if we know that it's gonna cost us like all this time, we'd rather you be happy and like ruin the product. Like that's fine. have you seen this? Like as you talk through these issues of team and individual, have you seen these trends kind of crop up as like, you know, individual and team kind of battling each other?
Yes. I think I want to approach this from the angle of what I know to be true from research rather than my experience.
Okay. Yeah, please.
Because most of my experiences have been in agency environment where we were able to do a lot of new and fun things because that just so happened to also align with our clients' interests.
Yeah.
Right. So like playfulness was a part of that environment a lot of the time. Not always, but a lot of the time the flashy stuff that we, mm-hmm. you know, got into this to do in the first place, clients love that. And they're like super excited about it. They're ready to throw a bunch of money to, you know, towards it because that's unique or
yeah.
you know, even if you can't justify it from a metrics perspective, the clients are happy that you're doing something that's cool, that's
yeah.
unique for them.
More pop.
Exactly, yeah. and it's not always true that they're willing to throw a bunch of money at it, but they are willing to support it at least, which is, you know, half the battle. Mm-hmm. So, and then on the flip side, in startup world, where most decisions need to be justified, and most, maybe even all, decisions have to be justified to some degree and justified from the perspective of, you know, why did you do this rather than doing the easier thing, right? Which is a business problem to solve.
Yeah.
So, but let's back up and talk about this more from kind of the proven perspective, right? We know that teams are better when they have autonomy. Mm-hmm. We know that teams are better when they feel a strong sense of belonging, mm-hmm. when they have a consistent a demand of learning, right? This is a study that was published 20 years ago, by the way. So it was well established. We know that people...
Which study? So I can link it.
This is Gallup.
The Gallup study. Okay, cool.
Major study. The book that you want to read on this particular subject is called Break All the Rules. I didn't know it was this old, by the way. The only reason that I found this out, this is kind of a fun bonus fact here. I was watching The Office, as you do on paternity leave.
Of course.
And I noticed that Michael Scott had this book in his office.
No way.
And I'm like, wait a second, The Office is old. Like, we're getting to the point where The Office is like, you know, classic TV.
Oh, yeah.
And so I looked it up and turns out this book came out 20 years ago.
Oh, man.
It feels highly relevant to our current situation with management in tech companies especially. So, you know, the book lays out these 10 things that you need to excel basically as a team. And the very first one, by the way, is clarity. So if you're not doing... if you're seeing problems on your team, try to chase that down first. If you don't have clarity on the team, then you know that's probably your primary issue. But we also know that people feel people perform much better if they feel they have a friend on the team, right? So if you can tell me which OKR you have in your team that is building friendships, then you know. Show me your job postings, I'll retweet them, right? Because this is super, super uncommon to see people actually like trying to optimize for all of these things that are like otherwise very difficult to tie to business outcomes.
Yeah.
And I think that the autonomy, the drive, the purpose, all of those things that, you know, we all know is motivating for us, those are hard to get everybody aligned on, mm-hmm. right? Let's take it from the code level. Installing the new thing, the new CSS framework, the new JavaScript thing, you know, trying this new perspective. How can we tie that to some successful business outcome when objectively on paper it's going to take more time? Well, we can look at the long term. And this is the heuristic that I think is really important. Right. When we talk about teams and we talk about teams that you're going to be happy on, the team that focuses on the long term is more likely to care about your happiness just naturally, right?
Yeah.
A lot of those things are just going to align. If you say, okay, are you focused? Do you want me here for 2 years or for 10 years? That's a great question to ask in an interview, right? Because if they say, oh yeah, we're just trying to, you know, sprint towards an IPO and you're just here to build this product and then, you know, do whatever you want to after that. Well, you're probably not going to have autonomy as a really high value in the company, right? This is one of the reasons why well-established companies tend to have some of these things in place, like benefits that they provide, actually tend towards supporting these ideas a little bit more, right? That's why management becomes really important to these big companies, because they're more likely to be focused on these longer term outcomes rather than the shorter term sprints. And so I guess all that to say, you know, if you're looking for a job or if you're trying to figure out like, how do we reconcile this difference between autonomy and playfulness and, you know, real concrete business outcomes, ask the question first, where's your focus? Is the focus on the short term or is the focus on the long term? The long term, most likely, that's the kind of place that you want to be if you're interested in being motivated and having those playful things to do. The long term, that's the kind of place you want to be.
That's where we leave you today. Join us next week when we talk with Jonathan about the future of work, how to find a sense of presence when your entire team is remote. Thanks to our two terrific sponsors, TopTal and Level Up Tutorials. Have you got what it takes to join the world's top 3% of freelance developers? Test your skills today. Go to toptaljobs.com and take back control of your career. Join me and my team as we learn how to animate and react from the best. Go to leveluptutorials.com. Buy the same React Spring course that I recommend to all of our engineers. It's so good that the things that he identified as hard parts and things that you need to be cautious of are actually informing the next versions of the API. Go to leveluptutorials.com to become a better web developer. This episode of React Podcast was edited by Mikhail Delport. It was produced by Mikhail Delport and Sarah Jackson. You can find React Podcast on Spec, a network to help designers and developers level up. Visit spec.fm to find other shows that will take you further in your career. Help us out by reviewing this show on iTunes. Your reviews help the show grow and help us ensure great guests and awesome content week to week. To join the discussion, visit reactpodcast.com/chat or follow us on Twitter at React Podcast. I'm at Chantastic. To stay out of the discussion but get updates, visit reactpodcast.com/news and sign up for emails. Thanks so much for giving us your attention. We'll be in your ears again next week.